sob. Like a fucking Valkyrie, you know? Flying at that big-ass ship like she could take it down by herself. She did. Take it down by herself, I mean. Alex nodded. So, did you have a plan now that you're here? He couldn't talk about it anymore. She understood that. She let the subject drop. I was following you, she said, turning to climb up the deck to the main lift, a corridor for the moment. Now that Medina and the Typhoon are gone, we could actually move between gates again. That does open up some possibilities, Alex said. My to-do list has two things on it. First one's put the old girl shipshape again, and the second's figure out what to do next. That sounds perfect, Naomi said. They reached the galley. The tables projected from one wall, but there were built-in jump seats for times like this. She pulled two of them out. Let's do that. It turned out that Alex's first entry gave her days of work to do. He'd gotten a decent start on the re-up process, but the Rocinante had been dry for a long time, probably the longest since she'd been made by a Martian navy that didn't exist anymore. A lot of the systems were old, and the newer ones were replacements that didn't ever fit together quite the way the originals had. There had been a little corrosion in the reactor shielding. Nothing that time and use didn't justify, but something to keep an eye on. She felt herself falling into a rhythm she hadn't known existed and recognized perfectly. Normalcy. This was how life just was. And everything else she'd done, however comfortable she'd been with it, had been the aberration. Day after day, she and Alex went through the ship, troubleshooting each system as it came back up. A full crew could have done the whole thing in 10 hours, and there were only two of them. But they got it done. The reactor up, the comms, the power grid, the thrusters, the weapons. Some maintenance routines assumed there would be teams of four, but they found workarounds. One piece at a time, the Rocinante came back to life. As they worked, she saw some of the ways Alex's time on the Storm had changed him. Whether he knew it or not, he understood electrical systems better than he had before, and he'd learned some tricks about checking the stability of carbon silicate lace plating that shaved half a day off her estimates. At night, they slept in their old cabins. She didn't know whether Alex went through his cabinets, but she went through hers. She'd never had much that she claimed as her own, but what little there was felt like the artifacts of some other ancient Naomi. It was like coming across a favorite toy from childhood and being reminded of all the half-forgotten experiences that traveled with it. The shirts she'd worn that Jim had liked, the mag boots with the extra strap at the calf that helped stabilize her knee, a broken hand terminal she'd meant to fix before she went into hiding and hadn't ever gotten around to. There were other cabins in the ship, with other personal supplies. Things that had belonged to Amos and Bobby. Maybe even Clarissa. Maybe Jim. The trivial leftovers of a life. She was tempted to go through those, too, but she held back. She wasn't sure yet that she'd be doing it for the right reasons, and it turned out that mattered to her. As soon as the comms were up, the Rosie started gathering covert communications from the underground. Three bottles had passed through Freehold Gate since she'd left her shuttle, one from Sol, one from Asylum, and one from Patria. More would be coming. When she wasn't working, she paged through the information and listened to the reports of the leaders of the underground, of her underground. It was a week and a half after her arrival, and Naomi was out sitting on the desert sand as the sun set. The truth was that as much as she enjoyed complaining about being planetside, there was a kind of surreal thrill to being under a vast dome of air. After an hour or so, she had to go back inside or she'd start getting anxious. But for that first 30 minutes, it was beautiful. The sunlight seemed to sink into the sand, lighting it from within, and the star field that bloomed above her head was familiar, even if the high air made the steady stars seem to flicker and shimmer. It felt very strange to be in such a quiet, peaceful, empty place, and also the middle of a war. She heard his footsteps on the sand, soft and regular as an air intake gently cycling. She sat up and dusted the sand from the backs of her arms. Alex was wearing his flight suit, and it hung a little loose on him. Even with his usual beaming smile, he seemed a little deflated. He grunted as he sat on the dune beside her.
"You holding together okay?"
Alex asked.
"I'm all right," Naomi said.
"Just asking because you've been spending a lot of time working on the ROSI with me and then going straight to the reports and news feeds when you're done. You haven't taken much downtime."
Naomi felt an old, familiar touch of annoyance, and it was strangely delightful. If Alex had started his mother hen habits back up, it had to mean he was feeling better. Not recovered, maybe never that, but improved.
"Doing the briefings is my downtime.
Coordinating a massive resistance to an authoritarian and galaxy-spanning empire is your hobby? I didn't have an option. We don't have a go-go table, and, no offense, even if we did, you play like a Martian."
He chuckled to show he knew it was affection.
"Have you got a note back for them? Another bottle to pop out into the systems?"
It was a hard question. Even when she'd had her mind on the panels and wiring of the Rocinante, a part of her had been thinking about the grand strategy of the underground, about limiting Laconian reach and power, about taking advantage of the openings left by the enemy's mistakes, and about the goal at the end. That was the trick of grand strategy. Knowing where the journey was ending even when you were making up all the individual steps to get there. Working on the ROSI had given the insight she'd had on the passage out from Oberon time to season. What had been a vision of a possible future had, while she worked with her hands and taken her mind elsewhere, become a bone-deep certainty. As long as Laconia had the capacity to make ships like the Tempest and the Typhoon, it could never grow past being an oppressor. The dream of empire could only die if the ancient Martian dream of independence through better technology was put to rest. An attack on Laconia posed half a dozen unsolvable problems, and Naomi thought she had solutions to at least four of them.
"I've got some things I should send out. I can bounce a broadcast off the repeaters at Freehold and up to the Storm. Even if there aren't any ships closer to the gate than that, they can get one of their torpedoes going. And if they've been doing what they're supposed to, they'll have some bottles already on the float near the gates."
"Lightspeed is way better than the best drive,"
Alex said, nodding sagely.
"Trying to send a bottle from here would take a pretty long time. You know, though, there is a way to shave a few seconds off the time it takes to get your messages out."
She shifted to look at him. The sun was gone, and the rose and gray twilight made him look younger. She lifted an eyebrow, inviting him to go on. He looked at her with feigned innocence.
"All we've got to do is be a few light seconds closer, right?"
It hit her with a relief she hadn't expected. She looked up into the Freehold sky, past it to the stars.
"Right," she said. "Let's do that. I'm sick of walking on walls."
An hour later, they were strapped into their couches on the flight deck. Working the Rocinante's displays was like singing with an old friend as she checked the maneuvering thruster's output profiles. The reactor was stable. The thrust was good. Even after its long rest, the ROSI's power grid was solid.
"We're good," Naomi said. "Take her out."
"Oh, yeah."
The ship lurched, and the crash couches shifted. Naomi had the familiar sense of motion as they accelerated and then slid out of the cave on maneuvering thrusters only.
The deck swung around and down until it was under her, and she sank into the gel as Alex took them higher from the ground. When the drive kicked in, the whole ship rocked and shuddered, and Naomi felt the prick of the needle and then the coolness of the juice in her veins, keeping her from suffering the worst of the G-forces. Alex was grinning like a kid on his birthday as the old gunship rose again for the great emptiness. Naomi watched the external temperature as they rose, the atmosphere growing colder and colder, but also thinner and thinner, until there wasn't enough there to conduct away heat at all. The shuddering stopped, and the only sounds were the ticking of the air recyclers and the occasional harmonic chiming of the drive passing through a resonance frequency. On her tactical display, the planet fell away behind them, and they passed escape velocity. They weren't even in a long orbit of Freehold now. They were on their own. Free. Naomi shouted, a wide, celebratory yawp, and Alex answered back. She lay back in the couch and let herself just be home, just for a moment. The Rossi was an old ship now. She'd never be state-of-the-art again, but, like old tools, well-used and well-cared for, she'd become something more than plating and wires, conduits and storage and sensor arrays. Old Roku had said that after 50 years flying, a ship had a soul. It had seemed like a cute superstition when she was young. It seemed obvious now.
"God, I missed this," Alex said.
"I know, right?" An hour later, Alex put them on the float and Naomi unstrapped. Freehold's system was so empty there was no traffic control authority. No flight plans or patrols watching for drive plumes without transponders. She started her diagnostics running, but she already knew from the sound of the drive and the taste of the air that they'd come back clean. She moved from station to station, checking the displays and controls as if there were other crew members who might be using them. She didn't notice the change in Alex's mood until he spoke.
"I tried to keep her alive. I really did. Right at the end, she was out there throwing rounds at that great big bastard, and I was going to take us in, burn the storm right in there and try to get her back on board, but there wasn't time."
His sigh had a shudder in it.
"And it would just have fucked things up if I'd done it."
Naomi wrapped her hand around a foothold and braced. She turned to look at him, and this time he met her eyes. "She was a hell of a woman," Naomi said. "We were lucky to know her."
"The thing I kept thinking all the way out was, how am I going to tell Kit his Aunt Bobby's gone?"
"How did you?"
"I haven't yet. I couldn't stand to when we were in Sol System. And now, I still don't know if I can. I miss her. I miss all of them, but I watched her go and... shit."
"I know," Naomi said. "I was thinking about her a lot. I sent the okay for the mission."
"Oh, Naomi, no. This isn't your fault."
"I know that. I don't always feel it, but I know it. And it's strange, but the way I comfort myself, I think of all the other ways she could have died. Like oncocidal resistant cancer, a reactor bottle failure, just getting old and frail until the anti-aging drugs weren't enough anymore."
"That's a little macabre," Alex said.
Then a moment later,
"But yeah, I know exactly what you mean."
"It was Bobby," Naomi said. "She knew we don't live forever. And if she'd gotten to choose a way to go, I bet this would have been in her top 5. Alex was quiet for a few seconds, then sniffed.
"I miss her every minute of every day. But goddamn, it was just so fucking right.
Going hand to hand with a ship the combined strength of Earth, Mars, and the Transport Union couldn't beat and winning."
"Yeah. If we've got to die, I guess that's a pretty good way to go."
Still, I'm sorry we've got to die.
Mortality does suck that way, Naomi said.
What would be your way?
I don't know. That's not what I think about, she said, surprised that she knew her opinion about what aspect of her own death was important to her. I don't care how I go. There are just things I want done first.
Like what?
I want to see Jim again. And Amos. I want this war over with and a real peace established. The kind where people can be angry with each other and hate each other and no one has to die over it. That'd be enough.
Yeah, Alex said. That would. I think about Amos a lot.
Do you think... There was something like a great, soundless pop. A detonation without quite being a detonation. And Naomi fell. Would have fallen, if direction still existed. Everything had gone the electric non-color of eyes pressed too hard in the darkness. Nothingness buzzed around her like an assault. Somewhere nearby, someone was screaming. It might have been Alex. It might have been her own voice. The bright void she fell into, falling in all directions at once, had shapes inside the light, jagged and shifting as a migraine halo. She felt something missing in herself, but couldn't tell what it was. That frightened her worse than the suddenness and strangeness of the transition. The sense of absence without an object, of loss without knowing what had been lost. She tried to close her eyes, but nothing changed. She tried to reach out, but there was nothing to reach for, or with. She couldn't tell whether she'd just fallen into the light, or if she'd been falling for hours. She felt herself slipping into something else, something like sleep, but not sleep, and she resisted by instinct. A deep fear wrapped itself around her, and she held on to it as if it could save her. And then, without any more warning than had come before, it was over. She was on the Rosinante's flight deck. She'd drifted away from her crash couch. Behind her, Alex gagged. She grabbed a handhold and braced. Her body felt wrung out, exhausted, like she'd been awake for too many days and the fatigue had seeped into her muscles. Did we? She said, and her voice sounded weird in her ears. She swallowed and tried again. Did we lose time? The soft tap of Alex's fingers against a control panel. She closed her eyes, grateful beyond words that the darkness came when her lids fell. A wave of nausea came over her and left again.
We did, Alex said. Lost almost 20 minutes.
She pushed off, navigating her way to her couch by long instinct more than thought. She strapped in with a sense of deep gratitude. Alex's face was grayish, like he'd just seen something horrifying.
That wasn't like the other ones, he said. That was different.
It was, Naomi said. Alex checked over the Rosinante's status and seemed to take some comfort in it. Naomi was tingling, the pins and needles feel of a pinched nerve, but without a physical location on her body. Like her mind was slowly coming back. It was a deeply unsettling feeling. Fucking Duarte, she said. Fucking Laconia and their fucking tests.
What do you think they did this time?
Chapter 39. Elvi. Elvi's hand terminal chimed again. It was past time for her to go, but she couldn't pull herself away. Also, the girl in the glass cage didn't have a chair, and so Elvi had chosen to sit on the floor beside her. The prospect of getting back up with her aching leg wasn't pleasant. So, she said, it wasn't a change in cognition? There was a moment of eerie stillness, the off-putting pause that they always seemed to have, and then Kara shook her head. I mean,
It's hard to be sure what it was like, really. But I didn't have the feeling of being any different. Except for the library, you know. The library was what Kara and Alexander, whose nickname in the family had been Zan, called the information that they carried with them after their recreation by the repair drones. It was, according to them, like knowing things without having to learn them first. Sometimes the information was straightforward, like details about the local environment. Sometimes it was inscrutable, like the fact that substrate-level entities were difficult to refract through rich light. That was the most interesting example, because Kara understood what the substrate was, and what refraction meant in that context, and the nature of rich light. But the whole body of knowledge didn't connect to anything. There was no shared context with anything like food or trees or water. Any human knowledge. It was, Elvie thought, like finding a sea turtle who thoroughly understood Gödel's incompleteness theorem, but didn't have any sea turtly application for it. That kind of cognitive artifact was a large part of why Cortázar had drawn the conclusion that Kara and Zan weren't actually the children they'd been before they were repaired, but alien technology created using human corpses. It was a deep question, and one that Elvie struggled with. The children had clearly been transformed. The fact that they weren't aging or developing was evidence enough of that. The blackness of their eyes and the grayness of their skin dropped them straight into an uncanny valley that still made something in Elvie's hind brain recoil. But then, sometimes, when no one was observing them, Zan would put his head in Kara's lap so she could ruffle his hair. It was a moment that primates had been sharing back to the Pleistocene, deeper and more recognizable than mere humanity. Or Kara would crack a joke about something Elvie asked, and then smile almost shyly when Elvie actually laughed. Elvie's opinion shifted on them. Sometimes she was sure they were puppets of inscrutable alien technologies. Sometimes it seemed obvious that Cortázar had built his case that they weren't human, just so he could keep them in a cage for a few decades and run tests on them. Elvie wasn't sure if she liked them, or if they scared the shit out of her. If they were passing their Turing test, or if she was failing it. But it was interesting that none of Cortázar's work on Duarte seemed to have resulted in the High Council's getting access to the library, and the weird turning off of consciousness hadn't broken Kara and Zan the way it had Duarte. There was a clue in there somewhere. She had the dataset. She just needed the right grid to put over it, and the pattern would make sense. She could feel it. Her hand terminal went off again, this time with a message. Her transport had arrived. She was late for the briefing. She muttered something obscene and started levering herself up to standing. "I have to go." "We'll be here when you get back," Kara said, and after a pause, Zan laughed. Elvie smiled too. It was silly to treat them like she'd been having lunch with friends and had to go too soon, but there she was. Sometimes she was silly. She leaned on her cane as she made her way out through the labs to the fresh and open air. Her leg hurt. The regrowth, as simple as it was going slowly. Poorly. Faez's new foot was already in place. The skin a little paler and softer, the new muscles still prone to cramp if he walked too much. But he'd regrown bones and tendons and nerves, and she was still leaning on a cane. The difference, she knew, was the stress. Faez was almost ornamental in her present life. He slept in, ate at the state building, visited with whoever came through the gardens, or read books, or watched old entertainment feeds. He recuperated. Elvi was diving through Cortassar's data when she wasn't examining Duarte's condition, or trying to keep Teresa from being murdered in the name of curiosity, or going over her own data from the Falcon. She was barely sleeping, and when she did, it was just rolling the dice to see what flavor of nightmare was taking its turn. There would be a point when it was all too much, when the intrusive image of Segale with a part of his head missing wouldn't let itself be kicked down the road for her to think about later, even one more time. When she'd break. It hadn't come yet, though, so she didn't have to deal with it. She was very aware that she was working on what Faez called "fuck it if it's not happening right now" protocol. Worse than that, she was coming to a place where she enjoyed the intensity. She had never been under more stress in her life, except maybe once back on Illus. Everyone had been going blind, and there were neurotoxin-covered slugs crawling up out of the ground and alien artifacts coming to life and people murdering each other over political issues and personal pride. Everything had depended on her talent and the sharpness of her mind, and now it did again. And part of her loved it like it was sugar. Probably not a healthy part. The driver waiting for her had an umbrella up to shield her from a light, misty rain. He didn't speak. When she got to the car, she leaned toward him. "Let Trejo know I'm on my way." "I already have, Doctor," the driver said. Drivers, Elvi thought as they pulled away, were a strange kind of affectation. It would have been easier to have a transport just pick her up and take her without another human involved. Having someone there whose job was to be deferential to her actually slowed things down. An extra layer of processing. Like the pause the children had. She wondered if it was like a stutter. She had to read up on that. Maybe there was something useful in it. The state building was wreathed in mist. The car's heater wasn't quite enough to push back the cold that radiated from the window. Early winter on Laconia, on this part of Laconia anyway, seemed to involve a lot of chilly days and bitter nights. As soon as the sun went down, all the mist would turn into an all-encompassing layer of ice. The local trees had all retracted their leaves. The imported ones had seen all their chloroplasts die out and were in the process of dropping red and yellow and brown remnants. Inside, the climate was warm and dry, as controlled as a ship's, but the light from the windows was muted and gray. It still smelled like rain. A different servant took her jacket and asked if she wanted a snack or a cup of tea delivered to the briefing room. She said yes, out of habit. Her attention was already divided between the past, sitting with the children or alien child corpse puppet things, and the future, her report and analysis of the most recent mass blackout event. There was literally no room in her awareness for the present. The briefing room was beautiful. Walls of polished rosewood with a subtle gold inlay, and lights set behind frosted glass that left the place shadowless. Trejo and Cortassar and Illich were already there, seated around a malachite-topped table. Trejo looked as bad as she felt, and Illich maybe even a little worse. Cortassar was the only one of them who was bearing up well under the stress. She was pretty certain that that was because he didn't care whether any of the rest of them lived or died. "Sorry I'm late," she said. "I'm sure you understand." "We've all been busy," Trejo said, and either it was a subtle dig or it wasn't. She couldn't tell which. "Regardless, we're all here now, and we have to make a statement about this latest event. What can the High Council say about it? What do we know? Colonel Illich, would you like to begin?" Illich cleared his throat. "Well, we experienced another event that appears to have simultaneously affected everyone in the system. And by simultaneous, again, I mean that it appears to have been a single non-local event that happened everywhere. We have reports that it also occurred in at least two other systems.
Cortázar raised his hand like a kid in grade school, and Trejo nodded at him.
What happened in the ring space?
Cortázar asked.
Was it the same as in the systems?
We don't know, Illich said. We didn't have any of our ships in the ring space at the time. There's some indication that ships in the ring space may have been, eaten, if that's the term, the same way the Typhoon and Medina were. But I don't have confirmation. The event doesn't seem correlated with anything we did, but we only have an active naval presence in about 120 systems right now. If something happened outside of those, we might not know.
Seriously? Trejo said.
I can't overstate how devastating it's been to lose Medina Station, sir. Controlling that choke point was the leash we had on the Empire. Without it...
Trejo leaned back in his chair, scowling. He opened his hands to Elvi and Cortázar, giving the floor to them. Cortázar didn't seem to care, but Elvi found herself sitting forward to speak as if she owed the Admiral something.
If I can try to put this all in a wider context?
Please do, Trejo said.
It's about the nature of consciousness.
That may be a wider context than I was looking for, Major.
Bear with me, Elvi said. Unless we're reaching for religious explanations, which I'm not the person to comment on, consciousness is a property of matter. That's trivial. We're made out of matter. We're conscious. Minds are a thing that brains do. And there's an energetic component. We know that neurons firing is a sign that a particular kind of conscious experience is happening. So, for instance, if I'm looking at your brain while you imagine something, I can guess reliably whether you're imagining a song or a picture by seeing if your visual or auditory cortex is lighting up.
All right, Trejo said.
There's no reason to believe that a brain is the only structure capable of having that combination of structure and energy. And in fact, there's a fair amount of evidence that the gate builders had a conscious structure, a brain-like thing, where the material component wasn't at all the same kind of thing we use. Anecdotally, we found at least one brain-like structure that was a diamond the size of Jupiter.
I don't know what that means, Trejo said.
Like, we don't have a steel chamber in fusion reactors. We have magnetic bottles, magnetic fields that perform the same basic function as matter. The older civilization appears to have developed its consciousness in a form that relied more on energetic fields and maybe structures in unobservable matter than the stuff we made a brain from. There's also some implication that quantum effects have something to do with our being aware. If that's true for us, it was probably true for them. My thesis, the one I was working on before I came here, explored the idea that our brains are kind of a field combat version of consciousness. Not too complex, not a lot of bells and whistles, but takes a lot of punishment and keeps functioning. Our brain may actually have a kick-starting effect. So when the quantum interactions that underlie having experiences break down, they're easier to start up again. Does that make sense?
Trejo said, barely, at the same time Cortázar said, of course. The two men looked at each other. Elvi felt annoyed at both of them, but she went on.
So, the scenario that James Holden brought back from the alien station in the ring space was of something systematically destroying the consciousness of the older civilization, killing it. The previous civilization tried getting rid of systems, inducing supernovas. That didn't help. They eventually closed all the gates, and that didn't fix the problem either, because whatever it was killed them all anyway. And that's where we came in. We found and I have directly observed things that we call bullets, or scars, or persistent non-local field effects. Basically, a place where whatever hates the ring gates has done something to collapse consciousness on a planet, or in a system, or in all the systems at once. What I suspect, and I don't have any data for this, is that the enemy figured out how to snuff out all the systems at once, whether the gates were active or not. I believe that our travel through the gates is irritating to these beings, maybe even damaging in some way. When that damage gets high enough, they react.
So, when I killed Pallas Station in Sol, Trejo said, you also hit some weird aphysical dark god in whatever passes for its nose,
Elvie said.
And they did what you'd expect them to do. If you get sick, and a penicillin shot makes you better, then the next time you get sick, you try another shot. Only it turns out we aren't the same kind of conscious system as the gate makers. We don't break as easy, and we recover better. What slaughtered their civilization just lost us a few minutes of time.
How disappointing for the dark gods, Trejo said.
Right? But then they're not done. Especially, and no offense here, when we start dropping bomb ships into wherever they are, playing tit for tat. And the way this one felt different, light and shapes instead of that kind of hyper-awareness.
I did notice that, yes, Trejo said dryly.
I believe that the enemy, whatever it is experimenting with new ways to break conscious systems. Brains. I think we're the equivalent of a penicillin-resistant infection, and the last event we experienced was an attempt at tetracycline.
And the trigger? Trejo asked.
There doesn't need to be a trigger, Elvie said. If the enemy has gone past being purely reactive, maybe we just convince them to take us seriously.
Trejo sank a little as the implications unfolded in his mind.
Is this new information? Cortázar said.
I feel we've covered this all before. I mean, nothing in this is really new, is it?
Trejo and Illich exchanged a look.
It's useful to me, Trejo said, to have Dr. Okoye's summary.
So yes, do we have any progress on healing the High Council?
It would be helpful, Cortázar said, if I could examine Illich's cast-off. I don't suppose there's been any new word on finding it.
Trejo's effort to hold his temper was visible.
Before we move on to that, if we could address the health of the High Council?
He's stable, Cortázar said.
Very stable. Perfectly fine.
Improving?
No.
Illich broke in, his voice tense.
Is there no way we can get him back?
Elvie wasn't going to let Cortázar bullshit this one anymore. Either he had a plan he'd been holding back for his own reasons, or he didn't. She leaned forward and put her hands on the desk, palms down, like she was revealing a hand at a poker table.
I don't see any realistic path toward returning him to his previous state.
Trejo nodded to her and shifted to Cortázar.
Do you disagree?
Cortázar squirmed.
His previous state? Probably not. But moving him forward into a new state is much more plausible. Easy, even. And more than that, instructive.
Trejo went terribly still. A soft tapping came at the door, and the servant came in with Elvie's snack. She'd forgotten all about it. When the door was closed again and privacy restored, Trejo hadn't moved. His eyes weren't focused on anything in the room, and his skin was pale. It took Elvie a moment to understand what she was seeing. All this time, Trejo had hoped. He'd believed that his leader would return, that the righteous king would rise and retake his throne. Despite everything Elvie had said, the admiral had believed Cortázar could Merlin his Arthur back from madness. She was watching Trejo realize
he had just been letting someone play with the corpse. She was someplace between horrified for him and relieved that he'd finally heard what she'd been saying all along.
All right, Trejo said, and then again more slowly. All right. The High Consul is going to have to make a statement all the same. We'll draft something.
We can say that the event was a test, Illich said. The High Consul's elite team has made a breakthrough. A new weapon against the enemy.
Or we could tell them the truth, Elvi said.
Trejo stood, his hands clasped behind his back. The anger and irrationality in his expression were grief. Grief made people crazy. When he spoke, his voice buzzed with barely controlled rage. Not at Cortázar, either. At her.
I don't think you understand exactly how precarious our situation is here, Dr. Okoye. I have a two-front war with no fronts. This is not a moment to undermine and degrade the confidence of our troops or embolden separatist terror. You have just outlined a war on a cosmic scale. I can't prosecute a battle against your dark gods while guerrillas degrade our forces. We have to unify humanity for this. We have to strike with one will. We can't afford to fuck around knocking each other's comm relays down anymore. That is going to get us all killed. Do you hear what I am saying?
I do, Elvi said. And she was surprised by the steel in her own voice. Trejo heard it too. I'm hearing you say you can't handle this. You want the fight with the underground over with? Easy to do. Surrender.
Your jokes aren't funny, he said.
409.
When they're not jokes.
Chapter 40. Teresa. Every night she went to sleep, Teresa thought that maybe the next day would be the one that brought her father back. Like with the story of Pandora's box, all the other fears and nightmares were made bearable by that one hope. Every morning that she woke, there was that sense of possibility that stayed bright as long as she could keep herself from checking in. And then Kelly, her father's personal valet, would tell her that nothing had changed, because of course it hadn't. She'd feel let down again, and still, idiotically, stupidly, like a cartoon character with an empty grin, the thought would come up, maybe tomorrow. Always maybe tomorrow. His rooms weren't grand. They never had been. A bed frame of natural wood and a thin mattress that he would rest on, even after he'd outgrown sleep. A desk with metal, locking drawers, and a screen built into its surface. The only decorations in the place were a picture of her as a child, one of her mother from when she'd been alive, and a simple glass vase big enough for a single flower that Kelly replaced every day. Winston Duarte, High Consul and architect of the Laconian Empire, had taken pride in having a simple man's quarters. The greatness of Laconia wasn't in its gaudiness, but in its works. The vastness of the Empire's ambition would have made any man seem small, even him. That was how she thought of it anyway, what she'd believed. Now he sat at his desk, his head shifting, as if he were trying to follow the flight of insects that only he could see. His hands rose sometimes and then drifted back down like he'd started to reach for something and then forgotten what he meant to do. Kelly had brought her a wicker chair to put beside him. Teresa sat on it, her hands clasped on her knees, watching him for any sign of improvement. Any hope that today might be the tomorrow she kept herself alive for. Daddy, she said, and he seemed to react to the sound. He turned a degree toward her, and even though his eyes didn't meet hers, something like a smile touched his lips. Kelly kept her father's hair well combed, but it seemed thinner than she remembered it.
grayer, greasier. The ancient acne scars on her father's cheeks made him seem rougher, more worn than he actually was. There was an amazement in his expression, like he was constantly discovering wonders that commanded his attention more than she did.
"Daddy," she said again, "he's going to kill me. Dr. Cortázar, he's going to kill me."
He turned toward her more, his brow taking on a gentle furrow. Maybe he'd heard her. Maybe it was coincidence. He reached out his hands to pat at the air around her head the way he did sometimes, only this time she took his fingers in hers, pulling his hands down, pulling his face toward hers.
"Are you there? Do you understand what I'm telling you? He wants to kill me. He wants to pin me down and cut me up like those frogs. And no one's helping. No one even cares."
She was weeping now, and she hated that she was.
"Come back," she whispered. "Daddy, come back to me."
He opened his mouth as if to speak, but only made wet clicking noises, like meat being moved by a butcher. He frowned for a moment, then looked away toward the window.
"Daddy," she said again, and then, "Daddy."
He flinched at the sound. The door opened behind her, and she heard Kelly's gentle cough. She dropped her father's hands and wiped her tears away. Not that she could hide the fact that she'd been crying. The best she could do was to show that she'd stopped.
"Is there anything I can get you, miss?" Kelly asked. He wore his usual red porter's uniform.
She'd known him forever, since she was a child gambling down the halls with the puppy who would grow up into her muskrat. He'd brought her tea and served her meals. She'd cared about him the way she cared about doors and pieces of art, as a thing, a function, an object. Now they were in the room together, and she saw him as a person, an older man, as devoted to her father as anyone could be, as complicit in hiding what he'd become as she was.
"Does he change?" she asked. "Does he ever change?"
Kelly lifted his brows, looking for what to say. His sigh was soft and apologetic.
"It's hard to say, miss. There are times he seems to know where he is, who I am. But that may be wishful thinking on my part."
Her father had drifted back to following his invisible bugs through the air. His forehead smoothed. If he'd heard her at all, understood her at all, he'd been distracted from it. She shifted her weight, and the wicker chair creaked under her.
"I'll come back," she said. "If he changes, if he gets better,
I will see that they tell you immediately," Kelly said.
She rose, feeling disconnected from the motion, like she was watching a Teresa-shaped balloon with its string cut. Kelly stepped over to take the chair away as she walked to the door.
"He would be glad to know you came," Kelly said. "I can't say if he knows we're here, but if he did know, he'd be glad. I believe that."
He meant the words as comfort, but Teresa couldn't bring herself to care. She walked out without thanking him, or cursing him, or doing anything but putting one foot in front of the other until she was out of the private rooms. The public parts of the state building, where the mechanisms of government went on, were as busy and efficient as ever, like a beehive or a termite hill that was unaware that its queen was dead. No one stopped her or made eye contact. She passed through on the way to her own rooms like a ghost. All she wanted was to lock her doors and crawl into bed and pray for a dreamless sleep that would carry her to tomorrow. Or later. Or at least not now. But when she got there, her door was open. Colonel Illich was sitting on her couch. He didn't look up as she came in.
"Where's Muskrat?"
Teresa asked.
She's in the bedroom. You missed your tutorial this morning, he said, his voice pleasant and non-judgmental and false as a mask.
Teresa folded her arms. I was with my father.
I respect that, but your father would want you to perform your duties, all your duties. That includes your education.
Illich stood, pulling himself to his full height like it might lend him more authority.
And your breakfast.
I wasn't hungry.
That isn't the issue. We are in dangerous times, Teresa said. A precarious situation.
We have to keep up appearances, I know. Everyone keeps telling me.
Then stop acting like a spoiled little shit and do your part, Illich said.
It was fascinating to see his expression when the words were out. She was so used to him being in control, professional, approachable, friendly. The shock widening on his face, and the pursed-lipped chagrin, and then the pleasure, pride even. It didn't take more than a few seconds, but it told its own little story.
You, he said before she found the words to throw back at him, are the High Consul's daughter. You are the face of your family. That makes you the stability of the Empire.
The Empire's fucking wheels are coming off, Teresa shouted. Everything's falling apart. What do you want me to do about it?
His voice was tight and controlled. I want you to eat your meals. I want you to show up for your lessons. I want you to project normalcy and stability and calm to everyone who sees you. Because that is your duty to your father and the Empire.
The rage felt like it was lifting her body. She didn't know what she was going to say. She didn't have an argument or a stance, only the power that came from being incensed beyond her capacity to contain it.
But you can spend days running around looking for Timothy. You can have Dr. Okoye come teach because nothing she does is as important as making sure you can finish killing my friends. You aren't doing your work either. So you don't get to tell me to do mine. That's hypocrisy.
Illich looked at her, looked deep into her eyes, and he chuckled. He reached out and ruffled her hair like she was muskrat, and he was scratching her ears. It was gentle and humiliating. Teresa felt her rage stutter and die, and a vast embarrassment flood into the place it had been. She wanted the anger back.
You poor kid. Is that what this is about? The spy? You're mad at me because of him?
I'm mad because of everything, she said. But there wasn't any power behind it now.
He wasn't your friend. He was a spy and an assassin. He was here to kill us. That cave of his, he picked it as shelter for when he set the pocket nuke off. The mountain was a landmark for his evacuation team.
That isn't true. He took her arm just above the shoulder. His grip was tight enough to pinch.
You missed your tutorial this morning. We'll make it up now. You'll need to learn something.
The security offices of the state building were familiar to her. They were offices like any other branches, except for the occasional reinforced door and blast-resistant lock. There were cells there for political prisoners, though she didn't know if anyone was in them besides James Holden. The forensics lab, however, was new. It was a wide room with a high ceiling and movable partitions that could seal off a section and keep its atmosphere separate. Fume hoods with Waldos and blast-resistant glass lined one wall. The tables that filled the center of the room had aisles between them, wide enough for specialized tool carts, chemical, biological, electronic, computational, to be wheeled to wherever they were needed. Half a dozen people stood at the workstations, and on them, Timothy's things, the carved wood tools, the cot, the cases and boxes that had been his.
Even one of the repair drones that had apparently been damaged somewhere in the violence lay on a table, the size and rough profile of a dead animal. Illich cleared the room so they would be alone. The technicians left, trying not to be obvious in the ways they stared at Teresa. She saw the curiosity in their faces. What was the High Consul's daughter doing here? What did it mean? The weight of their interest was like a hand on her shoulders pressing down. When they were alone, Illich put her on a technician's stool and brought a data storage core over. She recognized it from Timothy's cave, though she hadn't thought about it much at the time. Illich synced a monitor, pulled up a file directory, and stepped back, gesturing to it as if to say, "Go ahead, look." Teresa found she didn't want to. "Start with the notes files," Illich said. "Let's see how much Timothy was your friend." The notes were dates and times. At first, she didn't see any pattern in them, but the notations with the entries had a security note from the forensic tech. When she opened it, Timothy's entries matched the security logs for those dates. He'd been watching the state building's guards, working out their patterns and habits, looking for a hole. And he'd been tracking James Holden. Those records were more scattered, because Holden had less of a pattern. He'd drifted through the buildings and gardens as he saw fit, and Timothy, Amos, his name was Amos, had marked every time Holden came in sight of his watching post on the mountain. Once she'd gotten through the notes files, she didn't stop. She opened a tactical maps file and recognized the architecture of the city, of the state building. A series of files showed blast radii of a small nuclear device. If it were planted at the wall, if it were set off in the city, if it had been smuggled into the state building, each one had notes speculating on deaths, on infrastructure degraded. She opened a file called Evacuation Protocol. Topographical maps showed a primary evac site close to where she'd met him the first time, and a secondary a day's hike away. With notes, Timothy, Amos had added about what parts of the visible defense grid would have to be taken out for each site to be practical. Here is how he would have killed us. Here is how he would have left. Here is the man he came to save. Here are the people he came to destroy. She waited for the rage to come back. She expected it. Instead, she thought of James Holden. If he said he was your friend, then he was. "Do you see now?" Illich said. "Do you see what he was?" All these plans to kill her and her father, to slaughter them all. "You should lie down on the floor there, flat as you can. Put your hands over your ears, okay?" "Were those the words you said to someone you wanted to kill?" "I understand," she lied. "I do." Illich shut off the monitor. "Then we're done here." He took her arm again and led her away. She hadn't seen him order up food, but when they got back to her rooms, it was waiting for her, a thick, white, protein slurry like they fed to sick people. A steak of vat-grown meat seared black at the surface and warm pink in the center. Eggs, cheese and fruit, sweet rice with flakes of dried fish. It was all on a metal tray with a fork and dull knife. Muskrat trotted in, but caught the sense that something was wrong. When Illich held his hand out, offering to scratch her ears, she ignored him and went to sit on Teresa's feet instead. "Now then," Illich said, "eat your meal. Get some rest tonight. Tomorrow, you will be on time for your lesson. We will be in the East Garden where everyone on staff can see us, and you will act as if everything were normal. Do you understand?"
I don't want to eat this. I'm not hungry.
I don't care. You're going to eat now.
She looked at the food in front of her. Reluctantly, she picked up the fork. She remembered something from an old film she'd seen about a girl in Sol System, on Earth. I don't have to do this. Body autonomy is written into the Constitution.